Session number 12661, Mr. Ray, Reel 1.
Mr. Jim Ray, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Ray?
In the county of Durham, Fence Houses. That was where I was born, actually. County of Durham.
And what was the date?
7th of the 4th, 1913.
And what did your father do for a living?
Well, he was a miner. That was his living.
And how many were there in your family?
Myself, three brothers and one sister.
And was it a comfortable childhood you had? What was it like?
Very genial, very pleasant and homely. My father was a disciplinarian, and that kept us under control. That's how it should be, really.
Were you reasonably fed and clothed?
Oh, yes, yes.
And was he in the First World War?
Yes, he was.
What did he do?
He was in the Royal Garrison Artillery. He was a gun layer and other things combined to the Royal Artillery in the field.
And did he ever talk about what happened to him? Did he have a good war or a bad war? Or?
He didn't talk much about it, but I think he realised that it was a terrible war, World War One. He did say there was a lot of men who were killed outright, you know, even those artillerymen.
Now, what was your school? What school did you go to?
It was the elementary school at Fence Houses, a very good school. I enjoyed my school work there.
What did you like in particular?
I liked every subject. I was pretty average at some. I was very good at others. We had science. We had art. Woodwork. We had the usual three R's. That's the reading, writing, and arithmetic. And our teachers were very strict.
And you were there from what ages?
Well, I started as an infant, really, you know, in the infant classes at the same school, but in a separate branch, you know. And I was 5 years old when I started school. I remember going with my mother. She introduced me to the schoolmistress. Her name was Miss Potts. I'll always remember her. And I worked right through to the top seven. Couldn't get any farther at school, and I left when I was 14 years of age.
So that's 1918 to 1927 you were there.
That's right.
Did the, with you being, in a miners' family, were you much affected by the general strike, the miners' strike and the general strike?
Well, it affected, yes, it affected every family in the mining area, you know. There was quite a shortage of money, shortage of food, but we managed to be kept quite well, you know, food-wise. Everybody seemed to be in the doldrums, you know, just wandering about at corner ends, and sometimes they used to have some sort of sports, you know, to entertain the young fellas, like football, cricket, quoits, things like that, you know, to entertain ourselves. That's all we could do. Nothing else. Real doldrums.
Right, and towards the end of your school, I think you got a part-time job, didn't you? The
grocers. Yes. Well, I used to do it just before I left school. It was a grocery shop, Gallons, And I used to go and take out the orders, you know, to different places around the village. Help them make up orders, you know. And I used to get a cup, two or three bob a week. That was my pocket money.
Now, when you left school, what were you planning to do? I mean, did you have any choice in the matter?
Well, you might ask that question. And I had an uncle, he's my great uncle, and he's a master mariner, ship's captain. When I was about 13 years of age, well, he used to go away for long voyages, you see. We never used to see him from, we were perhaps 2 or 3 years at a time. He used to be on the Argentinian run, he used to be on the grain ships, and he served his time before the mast. And Australia, New Zealand, he'd been around the Horn, places like that, you know. Really good. He'd sometimes stay at our house for a few days. And of course, he got interested in me. He took me to Sunderland, where one of his ships was undergoing repairs. Yes, the ship was called the Highland Laddie. It was a grain carrier, and it was in dry dock for painting and repairs and refitting. And I had a good look around the ship, and I was very interested. From top deck, all the quarters, in the hold, in the engine room, right along even to the ship's propeller, inside the ship, the propeller tunnel. And I was really interested. The second time he had a visit, he came with the ship, and that was at Wall's End, the Otranto. The same type of ship, you know, it carried, it could carry passengers as well, a passenger cargo ship. And while it was laid up, well, that was my great uncle's holiday. Naturally, he was going from family to family, you know, because we all lived in a close community. There's my Aunt Jenny, anyway, my Uncle Farrell, my mother and father. And he had a son, of course. He used to spend time with his sons. And when his time was up and the ship was ready, off he went. Eventually, well, he had to talk to mother and father about this, because I was quite prepared to be a sailor instead of a soldier.
That's what it attracted you, this?
It attracted my attention more than being a soldier. But in the meantime, the years passed by. And the reason why I would have liked to have gone with my uncle as an apprentice, because he'd have taught me quite a lot of being a ship's master. But there's one thing that my mother didn't like. It was because he was a good rum drinker. And my mother thought anyway, that I would fall into the natural habit of drinking, you know, and being a sailor, rough jobs and different ports and things like that. And she totally abandoned the idea. Well, of course, my mother and father had an argument about it, so that's where it ended. That's where my sailor ambition ended. Kaput.
So what were you to do then?
Well, there's only the mining, the mines.
Was that about all you had, when living in fence houses, was that about your only option, really?
Yes, because there was a reasonable amount of employment, you know what I mean, but I fancied one, and there wasn't much money attached to being in the shopkeeper's business, you know, shop assistant. So I went on the mines. I left school on the Friday, and I started on the Monday.
And which mine did you start at?
Lumley Six Pit. There were some of them by numbers, you see.
And what was your first job at the pit?
Well, I went on the screens first, sorting out the rubbish from the coal, pulling it up one side, you know, and throwing it off.
Pulling the rubbish off?
That's right, yes. Separating, you know, manual. There's quite a number of people working on the screens. One side of the screen, and I was on the other side, and with all in a line, you know, throwing stones out of the coal until it was heaping up behind us, you know. That was our job.
Did you find it boring?
Well, it was very tedious. Your fingers used to be very sore. We had no gloves, you know, them days. Your fingers used to bleed a lot. I was fairly lucky because I was working on the screens during the summertime. And I wasn't on there long before I went down the pit.
So that was all you did? A screener just did that? That's all it did?
That was my first job, yes.
So when you went down the pit, what was your first job actually down the pit?
Pony driving.
What was it like going down the pit in those days? I mean, can you sort of... Because things have changed now, haven't they?
Well, I know it was a different. Well, you went down in the daytime, and you suddenly went into complete darkness, and all you had was a hand lamp. You know, there was no sort of the weather dress in our times now. You know, with uniforms and electric lights on caps and things like that. And some people just used to have an oil lamp, especially the men who worked in by, that sent on the coal headings. They used to carry out an oil lamp. And 8.5 hours down the pit then.
So you'd go down, and then where were the ponies kept? They were kept underground, weren't
they? They were all kept underground in a big stable towards the shaft. And they were immaculate as well. And they're all in their separate stalls. They all had their names. The other horse keeper, he looked after them well.
So you didn't actually groom and feed
them? Oh, no, that was the horse keeper's job. He used to do all that. That was his job, to feed them, water them, brush them down. And if there's any dirt or slurry on them, you know, there used to be regions in the pit where there's a lot of slurry as well, you know, pools of water. It wasn't all nice, straightforward running, really. And the horses used to come back. We used to lead our horses out and take them to the stable and put them in the correct stall, take the harness off, hang it up, the headgear, and put the strap around his neck. They all... He's, you know, there's no mares down there, they're all geldings, small, very small ponies they were. And there's always food for them in the trough. There's hay and oats, and the ravenous used to get eating the food. We used to leave then, we used to go up the shaft, collect it to pit bottom, and go in to the cage and go up in the cage. That was one working day.
When you got there in the morning then, what was the reverse? You'd pick up your pony?
Yes, the same applied every day.
But what do you haven't actually told me what you did with the ponies yet. So what was the job?
Well, you took the pony in by, walked in with it.
Would you always have the same one?
Yes. It's very rarely you changed. you changed the ponies. That was your pony. You looked after him, because if anything happened to that pony, there was quite a lot to be said about it. You know, there was no ill treatment. They were very docile and good, strong little ponies. And I used to love my pony. I did, even though they called him Lop. Lop, L-O-P, Duke, Tommy, Jackie, and Sam, Lop. They all had the names.
So you get Lop in the morning, you went in?
I collected him in the morning, took him in, and then put him in what they call the limbers. They were like shafts combined with a bow at the back and a piece jutting at the back and a hook. And that used to go into the tub.
And where did you take the tubs to and from? That was
well, we were only allowed to go as far as the what they call the flat. That was like a little landing. It was full tubs on one side and empties on the other. And excuse me. We had the elderly young men. They used to be called putters. And they used to take my empty tubs, take them into the workings, exchange them for the full one, put the empty one in and bring the full one out to the flat where I was. I was not allowed to go anywhere near the workings. That was my point, far point.
Was that because you were just young?
Yes.
Very young?
Yes. You got trained up in, you were trained in stages and ages, you see. And it was an exchange, an empty tub in, or filling the flat, you know, with empty tubs, and bringing one or two, depending on the levels, you know, full tubs out to the next stage and handed over to my mate, because it was quite a long distance in, you see. There's three, the out by one stage, and the in by stage, the middle stage, and the in by stage.
And you worked on the in by?
I was on the in by one, and I used to go to the middle one. My mate used to work in the middle one, taking them out like in a chain fashion, yes.
And how long were you doing that for then? You moved pit, didn't you?
Pardon?
You moved pit after a while.
Oh, well, I was on that one till I was about 17. And I was just about ready, you know, to start putting. Between 17 and 18 years of age, I had to be about 18, you see. It's a very heavy job. It's a lot. The in-by side was what they call the productive side. And the putters, they were paid by the score, 20 and 1. That was the score, 21 tubs, a shift. They were paid so much a score. I forget now how much it was.
Did the putters actually fill the tubs?
No, they called it the hewers.
So they just moved them?
Yes, they just moved them, yes. And sometimes the rail tracks were very rough, and there were 900-weight steel tubs, you know, mining cars, and they're quite heavy to lift, especially in a low area. But that was their job. Well, I had two cousins, and they worked in Wall's End, the Rising Sun Colliery. And I was proffered a job, being about 17 and a half, going with them to go on the face. It was what they call long wall cutting. It was a new type of coal-producing machine. And my job was to clean the undercut of all the loose, fine cut curvings with the picks, the revolving picks, you know, from the jib, collecting them, the long shovel, the handle, and getting out and putting sprags under the cut to stop the coal from falling in huge lumps right down the face. The face would be about 80 to 95 yards long. They call it a long wall. it serviced from one end and put on undercoating right to the other end. And then, of course, there used to be someone following up in a later time, boring holes in the coal for shot firing. Used to fire the shots in groups down the face and blow the coal down, and the undercut, see, it used to shatter it. And then they used to have fillers. There was a conveyor on as well, you see, a conveyor, a movable conveyor, to put the coal on beside the machine. It was all timbered up above and across. And the face timber used to be put in by the man at the back of the machine. The props, you know, the face prop, that made a two props and one bar right down, two feet apart. So that was roof support.
Was that one of the earlier coal cutting machines?
Yes, it was a compass stair machine because the coal was very gaseous, and of course gas is a problem in the mine and water, but gas is a very high hazard.
What precautions did you have to take with the gas, the safety precautions?
Well, you had to take a lot of. I wasn't in particularly. I was interested in it, of course, but the deputy used to take a safety lamp, the Davy safety lamp, and he used to test for gas, and that was measured by the cap on the flame, the percentage of gas. And he used to constantly keep watching for that flame, making sure that we had good ventilation, but there's still a lot of pockets of gas can escape and get round the roof into cavities and such like, you know, and build up and cause gas pockets, which could be easily ignited by any kind of spark.
Did you have the usual rules about no matches or anything like that?
Oh, yes. There were no smoking down there, no way. No contraband of any description, no lighters, no matches, cigarettes. They were strictly forbidden, and that was on the notice board on the shaft. And as a matter of fact, you used to get searched, spot check, before you went down. Didn't apply to me because I was only a young man, I didn't smoke. But you had to be prepared for eventuality. Somebody might take a cigarette down there and, you know, start smoking. Well, that was a good prevention anyway. One of the best things the miners adapted themselves to. Safety precautions.
Was the union very important? Were you in the union?
Yes. Oh, yes. You had to join the union. It was a must. It was the DMA then, the Durham Miners Association.
Now, how did you spend your time outside the pit?
Well, we had places to go to. There was a cinema, and we used to go to a place called the Oxford Galleries. It was quite a big place. It used to have a big dance hall, and it was also a skating, roller skating rink, and I used to go down there with my cousin. One or two of my friends I'd made up there as well, you see. That's how we used to spend our time.
Were you much of a one for sport?
Yes, I always liked sport, but there wasn't that many facilities for sport. And usually, when you came from the pit, you were very tired. Oh, yes.
Now, you didn't stay at the Rising Sun long, did you?
No. It was very unfortunate, because I liked being there, you know, up on the Newcastle side, the Tyneside, and because I often used to go down to the quay, have a look at the shipping that was come in.
So you were still interested
it was always in my mind. And it was very nice to see these big freighters coming in and passenger ships, you know. And that was Fenton, perhaps on Saturday morning, if I had the Saturday morning off, or a Sunday. I mean, I used to go down there, just to look around.
So why did you leave?
Well, I was called My father, he came through and he wanted me back home.
Why was that?
Well, I was making a small wage when I left home, and I was more or less part of a provender for the family, really. And he brought me out of a job, you know, back home. This was towards the end of the year, around January time. I know it was rough weather in January. Anyway, I got back home and I went back to the mine where I worked. And I was bluntly told I left the job and there was no further employment. See, I left on my own. And I'd have to wait until there was a vacancy. How long that would take, well, I don't know. Anyway, I didn't have much time, and as my father was getting on, he became unemployed. There wasn't much room for two of us on the dole, really. So I thought, well, the army is my best for situation at the time. So
you had no real vocation about joining the army. You know, it wasn't something you wanted to do.
No, that was my best. The only option open to me, anyway. So I went and joined the army in Durham City.
That would be the recruiting office.
Recruiting office.
And where was that at then?
I think it was called the Old Bailey. They had a recruiting office up there.
And what was the date, sir? I think 7th of... You told me before, 7th of January 1931. Would that be right?
That'd be right, yes.
And what happened when you went into the recruiting office? What was the procedure?
Well, there's an officer, the recruiting officer, and the sergeant, and... there were several of us in there. I think there must have been about a dozen waiting to be interviewed. Anyway, the first thing was medical examination, thorough. There's a doctor there, you know. Put your clothes on and went in a separate room. And there's someone attached to the military, like it must have been an ex-school teacher or someone. So he handed the book over and he said, start reading. You know? So we had to start reading and write stop. And then he gave us a few sums to do, arithmetic, you know, and about five sums. Then I was tested for my eyesight.
Were they easy, the sums? I mean, did you have any trouble?
Oh, no trouble at all. Quite elementary.
So they were just checking for basic reading and writing?
Adding up, subtraction, multiplication and things like that, you know, and one or two bits of... perhaps one on decimals and things, you know. So I walked through that one all right. That was no problem for me. Then I had an interview, an interview with the officer. He asked me a lot of questions. You know.
If
you had any criminal record and things like that, it was more or less how you'd behaved yourself. You know, if you had any charges or anything like that, which, you know, the against you or something like that. They didn't want to take any riffraff in the army. That was the idea of it all. And a dental inspection as well. You know, that went in with the health problems. And I got a form the attestation paper. And it'd give you all the ins and outs of swearing allegiance, you know, to the crown, his heirs and successors, and I had to take that home and get it signed and bring it back.